question on how we learn to see evil, and using the American novel Sophie's Choice by William Styron to clarify that vision of evil. How many people here have read Sophie's Choice? Oh, great.
I've seen the movie.
And seen the movie, too. Before we get into what the way we'll look at this thing, I would throw, how many people have seen the movie? And it's out in video, of course, and it's long, and Meryl Streep is, it might be her finest acting job ever, huh? Is it? She's awesome. The movie is about the psychological repercussions of surviving Auschwitz. And Sophie, in Sophie's Choice, has survived Auschwitz. The book, or the movie, is about the psychological and emotional scars. The book is about the theological scars. And it's about apostasy. It's about a woman who's lost her faith. And that'll come clear today as we talk about it. But I mention that because it's a profoundly theological novel. And there are several very explicit sex scenes in the book. And I had a colleague once joke to me, how can you teach that book? It's just about sex and drugs. And there are some scenes in there that are, as I said, that are really explicit. But they're there for a purpose that we, I hope, will explore a little bit today, too. And to make sure that we see those scenes, but focus on, the profound theological scars, the profound spiritual scars that are left on this survivor. So that's how we'll look at this. And I first have a little exercise from you. I've got my ideas from Dorothy. It says we, Dorothy Hall, you've been to her. Before anything starts, you have to do an exercise. We're just going to do jumping jacks. No. I'd like to have you think of a time when you saw somebody do something that you knew was wrong, and you kept silent, or you walked away, or somehow by your actions or by your inactions, you condoned that thing that was wrong. Think about those just for a second, and you don't have to write them down, but I'd like to list a few of them that we come up with. We're just pretty normal people, growing up in a pretty normal society. It doesn't mean good. Normal might not necessarily. But and when you've got those, and anybody ready to share, I'll list a few for you, and then we'll move on.
This happens, unfortunately, not completely and infrequently, and that is that I'll be in some kind of a public circumstance, and I'll see a hairy mom hitting or verbally abusing her child.
Child abuse. How many people have seen it? How many people, when you saw it, did something? I have to raise my hand on this too. But when I saw it, I didn't do anything. Both. Except continue to beat, except continue to beat my kid.
I've done
both. What?
I said I've done both. I stepped in a supermarket and made a real fool of myself and got in all kinds of trouble, and I've also not done anything.
Yeah. Okay, good. That's pretty common. Lots of us have seen it. Okay. Anything else?
Not confronting racist humor.
Yeah. You might not like it. I mean, we're all great people. We don't do this stuff. But we let those other people who are evil, do it. Or evil's too strong so far.
Why don't you just make that racist and expand that to any kind of ethnic and...
Sexist humor.
Sexist.
I'll just write discriminating.
Right. Homosexual.
Right. Sexual.
Sure.
Yeah.
Gay jokes. That's, all that. And we draw a line, don't we? I might not tolerate that racist joke, but a gay joke, that's okay. Or I might not tolerate the gay joke, but a sexist joke, that's okay. And we draw lines, or we don't really have lines. We don't even think about them, probably. Oh, keep going. That's part of what Sophie's Choice is about, is the unconsciousness of us as we encounter just daily experiences. That, for William Styron, ultimately lead to the Holocaust. That's where we're going. And we can all say, can't we? There's no way I would keep silent with something like that. Maybe a racist joke, or maybe when I watch my neighbor spank his or slap his kid in the face, because that's I did that, and I watched. But I would never tolerate a Holocaust. No way.
Bosnia.
Right? What?
Bosnia.
Well, now we get into some bigger stuff, don't we? That it's sort of beyond us, isn't it? Bosnia. Well, I can scold my neighbor for telling a racist joke or say something like, hey, we don't talk like that in our family, or we can do that, but Bosnia is a different story. We're a little, well, at least we feel that we're a little more powerless.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah. Anything else?
People taking the Lord's name in vain.
And I'll generalize that even more, just the kind of language we call it swearing. Yeah. I'd like to list a few more, if you don't mind, just to show all of us, to make it real clear how common this is, that we walk away from stuff that we know is wrong.
Think gossip.
Different category over there in Bosnia, though really an important category. Gossip. I'll bet everybody in this room, how many people averaged on the freeway at 70 miles an hour? I did. I mean, there isn't one of it, come on. Okay, so I'll just put MPH. Most of us disobey that. And I always come up to a stop sign, and if there's no bear out, don't you? Stuff, roll right through it. And I turn to my son and say, who's watching me, who's learning to drive, and instead of saying, as I probably should, do as I say, not as I do, I say, Martin Luther King taught me, don't ask if it's legal, ask if it's moral. So I rationalize this behavior completely. I can go through the stop sign. Okay. Anything else? Just for a second then, let's go in this category. Where we do feel, and maybe are, I don't know about that, but at least we feel so powerless. Bosnia. That's the only place that there's problems in the world, I guess.
Poverty.
Okay, and we can, of course, move that to anywhere in the world.
Violence in the city.
Violence.
Homeless.
Of course, and we can't go, you know, we can't offer food to everybody that's out there with no place to live, so. And how many quarters can you give out as you're walking, you know, up to visit the Washington Monument or something?
Yeah, there's also several more down there.
Would you get those chairs over there, please?
Just yeah, more people
come. Violence toward women.
Bosnia, poverty, city, violence. I'll just put an asterisk here. We could all name places from El Salvador to South America or South Africa to anywhere. It's all over the world. Well, I'd like to introduce Sophie's Choice by first looking at Elie Wiesel's Night. This is the scene. If you haven't read this, I would highly recommend this too, and you can read it in an hour and a half if you're a slow reader. And it takes me about two. if you're a fast reader, you're going to be faster than that. Elie Wiesel, his sister and his mother and his father have been pulled out of their home and they're on the railroad car. Auschwitz. No one had ever heard that name. We would be getting out here. There was a labor camp. Conditions were good. Families would not be split up. At 10 in the evening, everyone was looking for a convenient position in which to sleep for a while. They're still on the train. And soon we were all asleep. Suddenly, and I'll introduce a character that he has introduced earlier. Madame Schachter has had nightmarish visions on this train ride several times, and she just wakes up and, hey, there's fire, there's fire, there's fire! And they just ignore her at first because she's nuts. And then she'll fall back asleep. And then she wakes up again and says, there's fire, I see fire, I see fire! And finally they tie her down and gag her. And suddenly, the fire, the furnace, look over there! Waking with a start, we rushed to the window. Yet again, we had believed her, but only for a moment. But there was nothing outside save the darkness of night. And as she continued to scream, they began to hit her again, and it was with the greatest difficulty that they silenced her. Toward 11 o'clock, the train began to move. We pressed against the windows. The convoy was moving slowly. A quarter of an hour later, it slowed down again. Through the windows, we could see barbed wire. We realized that this must be the camp. We had forgotten the existence of Madame Schachter. Suddenly we heard terrible screams. Jews, look! Look through the window! Flames, look! And as the train stopped, we saw this time that flames were gushing out of a tall chimney into the black sky. We looked at the flames in the darkness. There was an abominable odor floating in the air. Suddenly our doors opened. Some odd-looking characters dressed in striped shirts and black trousers leaped into the wagon. They held electric torches and truncheons. Everybody get out! Everybody out of the wagon, quickly! Men to the left, women to the right. 8 words spoken quietly, indifferently, without emotion. 8 short, simple words. Yet that was the moment when I parted from my mother. I had not had time to think, but already I felt the pressure of my father's hand. We were alone. For a part of a second, I glimpsed my mother and my sisters moving away to the right. Zipporah held mother's hand. I saw them disappear into the distance. My mother was stroking my sister's fair hair as though to protect her, while I walked on with my father and the other men. And I did not know that in that place, at that moment, I was parting from my mother and Zipporah forever. I went on walking. My father held onto my hand. Form fives. Commotion. At all costs, we must keep together. A man came up, spitting oaths at us. What have you come here for, you sons of bitches? What are you doing here, eh? Someone dared to answer him. What do you think? You suppose we've come here for our own pleasure? You think we asked to come? A little more and the man would have killed him. You shut your trap, you filthy swine, or I'll squash you right now. You'd have done better to have hanged yourselves where you were than where you were than come here. Didn't you know what was in store for you at Auschwitz? Haven't you heard about it in 1944? No, we had not heard. No one had told us. He could not believe his ears. His tone of voice became increasingly brutal. Do you see that chimney over there? See it? Do you see those flames? Yes, we did see the flames. Over there, that's where you're going to be taken. That's your grave, over there. Haven't you realized it yet, you dumb bastards? Don't you understand anything? You're going to be burned, frizzled away, turned into ashes. We've got to do something. We can't let ourselves be killed. We can't go like beasts to the slaughter. We've got to revolt. One of the young men cried. Let the world learn of the existence of Auschwitz. Let everybody hear about it while they can still escape. But the older ones begged their children not to do anything foolish. The wind of revolt died down. We continued our march toward the square. In the middle stood the notorious Dr. Mengele, a typical SS officer, a cruel face, but not devoid of intelligence, and wearing a monocle. A conductor's baton in his hand, he was standing among the other officers. The baton moved unremittingly, sometimes to the right, sometimes to the left. I was already in front of him. How old are you? He asked in an attempt at a paternal tone of voice. 18. My voice was shaking. He's really 14, I think. Are you in good health? Yes. What's your occupation? Should I say that I was a student? Farmer, I heard myself say. This conversation cannot have lasted more than a few seconds. It had seemed like an eternity to me. The baton moved to the left. I took half a step forward. I wanted to see first where they were sending my father. If he went to the right, I would go after him. The baton once again pointed to the left for him too. A weight was lifted from my heart. Not far from us, flames were leaping up from a ditch. Gigantic flames. They were burning something. A lorry drew up at the pit and delivered its load. Little children. Babies. Yes. I saw it. Saw it with my own eyes. Those children in the flames. Is it surprising that I could not sleep after that? Sleep had fled from my eyes. So this was where we were going. A little farther on was another and larger ditch for adults. Pretty clear what that's about. And years later, when Wiesel wins the Nobel Prize for Literature, he gives this speech. It's pretty short. It is with a profound sense of humility that I accept the honor you have chosen to bestow upon me. I know your choice transcends me. This both frightens and pleases me. It frightens me because I wonder, do I have the right to represent the multitudes who have perished? Do I have the right to accept this great honor on their behalf? I do not. That would be presumptuous. No one may speak for the dead. No one may interpret their mutilated dreams and visions. It pleases me because I may say that this honor belongs to all the survivors and their children, and, through us, to the Jewish people with whose destiny I have always identified. I remember. It happened yesterday, or eternities ago. A young Jewish boy discovered the kingdom of night. I remember his bewilderment. I remember his anguish. It all happened so fast. The ghetto, the deportation, the sealed cattle car, the fiery altar upon which the history of our people and the future of mankind were meant to be sacrificed. I remember. He asked his father, Can this be true? This is the 20th century, not the Middle Ages. Who would allow such crimes to be committed? How could the world remain silent? And now the boy is turning to me. Tell me, he asks, what have you done with my future? What have you done with your life? And I tell him that I have tried. That I have tried to keep memory alive. That I have tried to fight those who would forget. Because if we forget, we are guilty. We are accomplices. And then I explain to him how naive we were. That the world did know and remained silent. And that is why I swore never to be silent whenever and wherever human beings endure suffering and humiliation. We must always take sides. Neutrality helps the oppressor, never the victim. Silence encourages the tormentor, never the tormented. About 6 years ago, probably about 8 years ago, was the first time I read Sophie's Choice. And it's a long book, and I'm not a fast reader, and I read it in two sittings. I was so enthralled. I couldn't stop. And I read it and was moved, obviously. And then I read it again, and I went to a colleague and said, you know, this has to be taught. It's got to be in our curriculum. This is a great American novel. And she said, it's maybe the best American novel of the 20th century, but it's too long to teach. It's 629 pages, those of you who are getting fired up. I hope you get more fired up as we go. And we're at Augustana, where I teach, we're on an 11-week term system, and it is a long novel to read in 11 weeks if you want to do anything else in the course. At that point, I didn't care if I did anything else. I'll just do Sophie's Choice. But so I didn't teach it, because we had that, I mean, a colleague I respected a lot, and we kind of arrived at that conclusion. But then I read it again. I can't do it. We've got to teach this. Well, then I said, this is an experiment. I'm going to stick it in the curriculum and see how students get bogged down with it. Well, I have now taught it at Augustana and in another place, too, but for five different terms. At the end of this class, I've asked students to evaluate the books in the course. And I'd like to say that the books in the course, just listen to them, Parlographist Barabbas, two short stories by J.D. Salinger, Dostoevsky's The Grand Inquisitor, Camus' The Stranger, C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce, the play, the American play, J.B., by Archibald MacLeish, and I may be forgetting some things, but good stuff, stuff that students really like. 5 years of teaching that novel now, and I've counted this. More than 90% of the students tell me that Sophie's Choice is the best book they've ever read in their life. Not the best book in the course. Almost all of them say that. And almost all of them say it's the best book I've ever read in my life. So there must be something to that. And before we go into Sophie's Choice, I'd like to ask you guys, how do we decide what good literature is? Because your English teacher told you. Or what kind of criteria do we bring to this? And I'd like to set you up before you go read Sophie's Choice or anything else, what it is that makes somebody decide this is really good. So for a little while, let's explore that. And I mean a little while, but just a couple minutes. What makes you like, you know, maybe the way to do this, I'll change the tactics right now. Let's look at television programs, because then we have, chances are we've seen more of those in common. Give me a really good television program. Give me a pretty good one. It's pretty hard to give a really good one.
I'll Fly Away.
Okay, yeah, I'll Fly Away. And of course, they didn't last. Good. A couple other good ones? Okay, let's give some so-so ones. Some that you watch, you know they aren't very good, but you're going to watch them anyway because you just kind of get sucked into it.
I like Northern Exposure.
Okay, yeah, a lot of people do, for sure. And that's making them too. Okay, just to go fast, what?
Life Goes On.
Life Goes On. That's enough. Give me some that aren't so good, but that you might watch. I have in mind something like Dallas. Did people watch Dallas ever? Oh, yeah. Paul laughs, Kathy raises her hand. All right, we're going to experience a little marital debate here. Or something like that. That just somehow, or that's really popular. Dallas, right?
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers. I might not have any juice in this. Cheers, Dallas. Are Cheers and Dallas in the same boat? Maybe they are. And give me an awful TV program that you know about, you've seen it once, maybe.
Married with Children.
Married with Children.
Two votes for that one. Okay, that will stop there. It's pretty obvious that we can come to this, you know, conclusion in our mind, individually at least, that some are good and some aren't so good. And what are some of the differences? I mean, what makes the program good? What makes you like something?
Well, one thing is that it moves me or makes me think. You know, it usually touches on something that I really care about.
I'm going to use the phrase like this. What engages us, or what is engaged in us? And our intellect is engaged in this program more than in this program. I've never seen this program, but I saw my kids watching it once and that was enough. Okay, our intellect is engaged. What else?
Well, in Life Goes On, there was a segment around a kid getting AIDS, and I wound up in tears on a couple of occasions, so it moved me some way.
So our emotions are engaged.
Vicarious experience. That people do things that I think about but I don't do.
I'm just going to put it in a 10-cent word instead of vicarious. The sense of other is part of what, maybe that is what vicarious means, it does to me.
How about being convincing? That is, we really can believe the characters that it really happened.
I am going to come out with a 25-cent word. It's truth. So no, the truth. Okay.
Good characters. People that are believable.
Yeah. And so in this truth, we've got the characters. And we also have the plot line then, and between the episodes and the story. Okay, good. Yeah, really good. Lots of things in our that make up what we are get engaged in different levels of this literature, and I'd suggest, I haven't seen Married with Children, so, but perhaps the reason we put it down so far is that not all of this is engaged in this. I haven't seen it, but let's just say for sure that my intellect is not engaged with Married with Children. Frankly, my emotions aren't engaged either. I remember when J.R. got shot, I coached too, and I was at the National Cross Country Championships with our team, and everybody watched it that night to see, you know, and then I think, yeah, that was the beginning of the season, November, yeah, right, would that be?
Yep.
And we were going to find out who shot J.R. way back in August, was it? Is that how it happened? Well, we all watched this, and I was intrigued too. I mean, I wanted to know who shot J.R., but that's all I wanted to know. I just was curious, whatever, you know, and that was it, and I didn't really fire up much to watch Dallas. My point is that some things can pull us in, and we can even be regular watchers, or we can be regular readers of certain kinds of literature. That's not necessarily bad, but it's one thing to be able to tell the difference between trash and good literature. It's maybe another thing to tell the difference between this good literature and this stuff that's great. For instance, why is Shakespeare better than Keats? Woo! That'll be your last question on your quiz today. some questions are a little harder to ask or to answer. Well, I would like to then ask you, and then we'll move right into Sophie's Choice. What things, what dimensions of what we are as human beings are engaged in the very best stuff we read or see? We've got them, some of them. Intellect, emotions, the sense of other, the sense that it is true to life, that it, you know, what we're after is the complexity, and I think maybe that's the way to put this with truth, the complexity of the human of the human experience. I use the case of my literature students that one of the reasons pornography is no good, it might be titillating, it might be, whoa, let's look through this Playboy to see all these pictures, but that's, it just engages a real small part of what we are. So pornography really is trash. And not because Dad says so or because some teacher says so, but because we can understand what in us is engaged. And if all it does is sexually arouse or just, wow, look at this, hey, guy, whatever it is, it's not complete enough. So even the people who like to look at that stuff, I would suspect, aren't going to keep coming back to it for any kind of real satisfaction because the complexity of the human experience, Sophie's Choice is about that. The scenes that none of my colleagues, they know better, but some of my friends have said, it's just pornography. The scenes that are explicitly sexual in this are there to show us this scene is going to fail you. It isn't enough. So when Sophie has sex with Stingo, that's described for a page and a half near the end of the book, you also know that, that Sophie has said, "Stingo, my favorite song," I'll read this passage to you, "my favorite piece of music is I Know That My Redeemer Liveth, but I can't listen to it anymore, because I know that my Redeemer doesn't live. Only a God who has turned his back on me could allow me to suffer with such guilt and such loss." And the guilt and the loss is her choice at Auschwitz, which we will get to. So then all of a sudden, in that book, pornographic, what some people might say are these, and I'm going to call them explicit sex scenes, are there for a deliberate purpose to broaden our whole sense of what the human experience is. And they also show for us that for Sophie, these things, the things that she goes through in her life after surviving. She survives, comes to America, and she does drugs a little bit. She does a lot of alcohol. She's a great person. You'll love her dearly. I guarantee it. But mostly she just dresses up in costumes and goes out with her boyfriend and tries to get a job and tries to sing and dance and listen to music, and none of it works. Because her apostasy is so profound, her loss of faith. And what she's trying to replace God with is an impossible filler. Whether it's sex, whether it's alcohol, whether it's jokes, and whether it's, most of all, for Sophie, repression of her memory. I'm not going to tell you these stories, Stingo. Okay, so when I say out there in the kiosk that I think of Sophie's Choice as the greatest American novel, I'm not going to get into a debate with anybody about that. It is clearly one of the great novels. This is why. When I teach Sophie's Choice at Augustana, I introduce it with showing liberation films of the concentration camps. And we have the actual footage of when the Americans came in and the British came in with their cameras and took pictures of the camps. And then I asked the students to write poetry after that. And here's just one, not a particularly good poem, but it says something about what I want to get into as we look at Sophie's Choice. This is one young woman's response. Again, they've seen these videos, and we've seen the bodies pushed into the ditches, and we've seen the bulldozers, and we've seen all that, and then they're there in the classroom. It hurts to think about this. I just want to sit in silence. I can't think of words to describe what I just saw. Powerful enough words do not exist. I feel like I'm in a daze. It would be nice to escape back to everyday life, my sense of reality, but that's the problem. What I saw was reality. But it's so unbelievable. And it's unbelievable in Elie Wiesel's Night when the beadle gets arrested. The rabbi, the guy in their town gets arrested and he gets up and somehow, it's never made clear, he gets taken away in the train and he gets to come back. How he got out of that deal, no one knows. And he comes back and he tells them they're gassing the Jews. They're packing them into trains and they're hauling them off to work camps and they're gassing them and they're burning them. You're crazy. It's not true. And nobody believes it. And that goes back to the very first exercise we had, some of the things that we turned our back on. And as those are not really evil, like going 80 miles an hour, 70 miles an hour, but we just turn our back. But the difference between what is believable and what is acceptable somehow gets very, very confused as we begin to draw our moral lines about what we will tolerate and what we will speak out against. And it has to do both with what is believable and with what is tolerable. Well, it's intolerable an Auschwitz, but it's also unbelievable, so it goes on. And silence perpetuates that. Well, there's a wonderful American novel, Moby Dick. That's the one everybody read and skipped all the parts about whaling. And it begins with this line, "Call me Ishmael." And Ishmael is then the storyteller of his voyage out into the sea to struggle against good and to struggle with good and evil. And it begins, "Call me Ishmael." William Styron, with a great sense of literary tradition, it's not his first paragraph, but his second paragraph begins, "Call me Stingo." And we have a story about Stingo. And when you read this book, and I encourage you to do that, and I've got stuff here I'll talk about later to help you do that. Know that this isn't just a story about Sophie. In fact, it's more a story about Stingo, the narrator of this book. And in reading it that way, that it's a story about Stingo, it becomes a story about us, too. And it's not just Stingo's journey into life. It's our journey into life. It's our journey into the awareness of good and evil on levels that we've probably never been before. In the dedication of the book, Styron says this: "I seek that essential region of the soul where absolute evil confronts brotherhood. I seek that essential region of the soul where absolute evil confronts brotherhood." And I guarantee you, as you get further and further into Sophie's Choice, all of you will be engaged. And there's probably still another level of ourselves that's engaged. And I don't know what to call it. If it's imagination, if it's just something as vague as spirit, but every part of us gets caught up in this story. Well, Stingo says, "Call me Stingo. Go with me on this voyage." And we're introduced early in the book to this, to his facile, banal lifestyle. All he's concerned about is the stuff that's in his medicine cabinet. He's only got $50 to live on. He's got a job, and his job is, and it's somewhat autobiographical about Styron himself, he's an editor at McGraw-Hill, and he reads books that come in and say, "Is this any good?" And he just dismisses them as trash, and that's pretty much what he does. And he's scolded at, early in the book, he is scolded at work for not wearing a hat. And then a little later, by the same guy, his boss, because, you know, he's got to look more businesslike. This is New York, and this is 1940, and 45, 46, and we've got to look like a businessman. And then he's scolded for not reading the New York Times, and instead he's reading the Washington Post. And that's a little bit too radical for some of the system. He's scolded for this. And we laugh at that. Yeah, that's right. We laugh and say, "Come on, get off it." But we begin to see early in the book how people just slip into what later we can call, and it's not fair to call it that now, but we later can call this kind of Nazi-like behavior and thinking that says, this is what you must do to survive in this, in his case, this workplace. Or in bigger context, in this culture. Well, Stingo basically gets fired from his job because he brings that, remember, if you're 40 or older, that stuff that blows up in big balloons, it's kind of hard plastic, and you blow it up, he brings that to work with him. Well, he should have known better, right? The guy wouldn't let him walk around without a hat. He blows that up and he gets fired. But before he leaves, he talks with his one guy above him, or one rank above him in work, named Farrell. And Farrell tells him of his own son, who was killed at Okinawa, and was there killed just days before Stingo himself had come in on a reconnaissance troop, just coming in looking things over. The war was over. And had Stingo been there 2 days earlier, Stingo thinks, it might have been me who was killed. And listen to the language that he uses as he describes hearing about the story. "Farrell's story had struck so deeply at my heart that for the first time in my life, I was aware of the large hollowness I carried within me. It was true, I had traveled great distances for one so young, but my spirit," remember this phrase, "my spirit had remained landlocked, unacquainted with love, and all but a stranger to death. I could not realize then how soon I would encounter both of these things, embodied in the human passion and the human flesh from which I had absented myself in my smug and airless self-deprivation." And those things would be embodied in Sophie as he gets to become good friends with her. "Nor did I then realize," another phrase to underline, "that my voyage of discovery would also be a journey to a place," and he goes on. So we take Stingo, or Stingo takes us on this, call me Stingo, on this voyage of discovery that takes him into the deepest regions of awareness and of evil. The story is Stingo's. The story really becomes ours. And it does so in a kind of a remarkable literary convention, which is we'll have the present told to us. So we're talking about Sophie and Stingo sitting around drinking a beer and talking and becoming friends. And Sophie has a lover. His name is Nathan. And all three of them become very, very good friends. And they go to parties. And they go to the Coney Island. And they celebrate great things. And they share wonderful intellectual ideas. And they are great, well-developed, profoundly developed characters. And his life unfolds for us with these other people. And we learn to love Stingo. We learn to love Sophie. We learn to love Nathan, who is Sophie's lover. And then Stingo slowly learns about death, and about love, and about his connection to all of that. Al Pitcher's, if anyone was there for his Vespers, talked about the connectedness of all people. And one of the things that Stingo becomes aware of is that his relation, that his life in America on one day somehow plugs into the life that Sophie has in another place called Auschwitz on the same day. And how are they connected? Remember, Al Pitcher said, if one person suffers, then I too suffer. And Sophie, or Stengel, becomes aware of that. Well, he meets Sophie. They live in the same apartment house. Nathan lives in one room. Sophie lives in another. Those two are lovers. Nathan is Jewish. Nathan is crazy. He's sick, really. And he's victimized by great bouts of depression, and he's schizophrenic. We don't know that at first. And I'm not giving away anything in the plot that will destroy anything for you, because it just enriches it. And that tumultuous relationship is somehow augmented by the friendship with Stengel. Well, Stengel hears Sophie, and this is really what this book is about. I once believed in Christ and his Holy Mother too. But now after these years, I was like those Jews who think God was gone forever. By the way, Sophie is not Jewish. She's Polish. And I think Styron, selects a Gentile to be the survivor of Auschwitz, again to establish the connectedness, that it wasn't just Jews. That's the only number we know in it. How many people died in the concentration camps?
6 million.
6 million is the common number, but I heard 12, and 12 is right. But they weren't Jews. 6 million is the one, and we somehow like that figure, I think, because we can just, somebody else. It's somewhere else, but no, it didn't just happen to Jews, I think. That's why Styron has his protagonist, his hero, be not Jewish. I was like those Jews who think God was gone forever. I said that I knew that Christ had turned his face away from me, and I could no longer pray to him as I did once in Krakow. I couldn't any longer pray to him, or could I any more cry? And when she asked, Sophie is talking about a lady she met in another country, and when she asked how I know that Christ had turned his face away from me, I said, I just knew. I just knew that only a God, only a Jesus who had no pity, and who no longer cared for me, could permit the people I loved to be killed, and let me live with such guilt. It was terrible enough they died like they done, but this guilt was more than I could bear. So, Stengel, I have lived long with this very, very strong guilt, which I can't lose. And her guilt, you'll learn through the novel much later, is dependent on lots of things and is born out of lots of things. One is people ask her to, while she's in Auschwitz, can you steal this radio for us so we can get, and she won't do it. So she deliberately refuses to participate in helping the resistance movement. And that's one source of her guilt. Another source of her guilt is she tries to seduce Rudolf Hess, an actual historical figure, fictionalized in this novel, to seduce him in order to try to talk him into letting her son, who's in the concentration camp across the road at Birkenau, be added to the Lebensborn, or the Youth for Hitler program. And she feels guilty about compromising her own morality about that, too. And there are lots of things that have to do with her own sense of guilt, besides her sense of loss. She's both been victimized and in some ways is a victimizer, and that's complicated. So Stengel, I've lived long with this very, very strong guilt, which I can't lose. Even though I know it has no reason, like that Jewish woman in Sweden said, when she tried to make me see that the love we had was the most important thing, not the silly fight with my husband, but I still have this strong guilt. And you know, there's one piece of music that I cannot listen to. It makes me cry so much my nose stops up, I cannot breathe, my eyes run like streams. It is in these Handel records I got for Christmas. I know that my Redeemer liveth, that make me cry because of all my guilt. And also because I know that my Redeemer don't live, and my body will be destroyed by worms, and my eyes will never, never again see God. The profound, poignant apostasy of this woman is clear. And it becomes clear, of course, to Stengel. I want to skip fast all the way to the end so we have a chance to discuss whatever you might want to approach. Well, we're introduced, like as Stengel is, to all different kinds and levels of evil. And one of these kinds of evil is with the character of Rudolf Hess, who is both historical and fictionalized here. And Sophie tells about Auschwitz, and then she tells about Hess, and Stengel talks about Hess. I was at Auschwitz for 20 months. When I arrived, everyone who was selected to be killed was sent to Birkenau. But very soon later, Birkenau became the place where only Jews were killed. I'm skipping some. Only, I did not die. I suppose I had more good fortune than others. For a time, I have a more favored position than many of the other prisoners because of my knowledge of German and Russian, especially German. This gave me an advantage, you see, because for this time I eat better and was clothed a little better and I had more strength. It gave me this extra strength to survive, but the situation did not last too long, really. And in the end, I was like all the rest. I starved, and because I starved, I had scurvy, I think it is in English. And then I had typhus, and also La Scarlet Fever, I think. As I say, I was there for 20 months, but I survived. If I had been there 20 months and one day, I know I would be dead. And she then tells about Hess and Stingo / Styron tells us about Hess. Now bound into a volume called K.L. Auschwitz, Seen by the SS. I read that. And it's a story of, it's autobiographical statements by officers of the SS. And Rudolf Hess's, who was the commandant at Auschwitz, his autobiography is there. And at one point he says, he's arrested and he's in Poland, and he says, people ask me why we didn't disobey Hitler, why we didn't assassinate Himmler. And of all of the thousands and thousands of Nazi officers that I know, I can't think of one for whom it ever crossed his mind. This automatic following of orders. Well, in K.L. Auschwitz, a scene by the SS, published by the Polish State Museum, maintained today at the camp, listen to Stingo. Remember, this is his voyage of discovery. What this landlocked soul is, which is unacquainted with love and all but a stranger to death. This anatomy of Hess's psyche is available for examination by all those who might thirst for knowledge about the true nature of evil. Certainly it should be read throughout the world, I love this, by professors of philosophy, ministers of the gospel, rabbis, shamans, all historians, writers, politicians, and diplomats, liberationists of whatever sexual persuasion, politicians and diplomats, lawyers, judges, penologists, stand-up comedians, film directors, journalists, in short, anyone concerned remotely with affecting the consciousness of his fellow man. And this would include our own beloved children, those incipient American leaders at the eighth grade level, who should be required to study it along with The Catcher in the Rye, The Hobbit, and the Constitution. For within these confessions of Hess, it will be discovered that we really have no acquaintance with true evil. The evil portrayed in most novels and plays and movies is mediocre, if not spurious, a shoddy concoction generally made up of violence, fantasy, neurotic terror, and melodrama. Right? But that's not real evil. And so we think when Arnold Schwarzenegger defeats somebody that, well, we've just watched good triumph over evil. It was Hess, who, having observed the effectiveness of a crystallized hypocyanic compound called Zyklon B when used as a vapor on the rats and the other verminous creatures that infested Auschwitz, suggested this means of liquidation to Eichmann, who, according to Hess, jumped at the idea, though he later denied that.
Question.
Yes.
Why in the world do you suppose he chose Hess to put in that position?
Hess was, historically, the commandant at Auschwitz, and that's where Sophie was, so he takes that historical position. Rudolf Hess
flew to England in 1941 or 42. He could not have been at Auschwitz during this period of time that book supposedly takes place. Hess,
the book takes place later than Sophie's story takes place.
No, I mean when supposedly that when was she supposedly at Auschwitz?
It never.
Well, the point is, Hess was really kind of a simpleton. I mean, he was devoted. He certainly was capable of saying that it never crossed his mind. He was more like a little puppy dog. There were certain people that were much more consciously evil. You know, I'm just kind of curious why the author would choose Hess.
I think that'll be, that's a great question. And the historical connection of that, I don't want to contradict you. I don't know that. I thought Hess was the commandant at Auschwitz.
Hess flew to England and parachuted.
Well, okay, but
with this mad plan for that he was going to convince Churchill that the English and the Germans really had more in common, that they should make peace.
Yeah. See, I don't know the history of that. Did he fly? Did he come back? What kind of position did he get then? And so on. But I think you'll see the sense of the mentality of Hess, and I think we've got to check our dates on that too. But until we do that, we'll just see what Hess has to, what Styron has to say about the kind of mind that he gives to Hess. Whether that's fictional or historical or not, we'll figure that out later, perhaps. Only a handful, but I think he's historical. Only a handful had a military background. However, this should not be particularly surprising. What I want to get us to is, when do we back away? We can always dump this responsibility, our silence, on somebody else. Only a handful had military background of those SS troops. However, this should not be particularly surprising. Military men are capable of abominable crimes. Witness in our recent time alone, Chile, Milai, Greece. But it is a liberal fallacy that equates the military mind with real evil and makes it the exclusive prominent province of lieutenants or generals. The secondary evil of which the military is frequently capable is aggressive, romantic, melodramatic, thrilling, orgasmic. Think about how evil has been portrayed in war in our movies, all the way from John Wayne up to Clint Eastwood, up to now Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the kind of, okay, and listen to his language again. Romantic, melodramatic, thrilling, orgasmic. I love this line. This is Hesse's simple mind. Real evil, the suffocating evil of Auschwitz, gloomy, monotonous, barren, boring, was perpetrated almost exclusively by civilians. Thus we find that the roles of the SS at Auschwitz-Birkenau contained almost no professional soldiers, but were instead composed of a cross-section of German society. They included waiters, bakers, carpenters, restaurant owners, physicians, a bookkeeper, a post office clerk, a waitress, a bank clerk, a nurse, a locksmith, a fireman, a customs officer, a legal advisor, a manufacturer of musical instruments, a specialist in machine construction, a laboratory assistant, the owner of a trucking firm. The list goes on and on with these commonplace and familiar citizens' pursuits. There needs only be added the observation that history's greatest liquidator of Jews, the thick-witted Heinrich Himmler, was a chicken farmer. The voyage of discovery. And how what Stingo gets tied into is that it's us. Whether simple-minded, and no matter how we put Hess or Himmler in historical context, whether simple-minded or complexly plotting out their plans of evil, they still get caught up in this barren, mundane. Well, Stingo gets involved. He learns some of these stories about Sophie's life and finally comes back to the apartment. And he's telling one of his friends about Sophie to make him, one of the other people in the apartment house, a little bit acquainted with Sophie. And the guy turns to him, and this is the beginning of Stingo's decision that I am going to investigate. His friend says, "What's Auschwitz?" And it's spelled O-W-S-C-H-I-T-C-H. He doesn't know anything. And the suggestion, of course, is we, too, ask that question. What's Auschwitz? Just a couple more things. Stingo has heard Sophie's story. Well, Al Pitcher's idea of connectedness. I had attempted more or less to successfully pinpoint my own activities on the first day of April 1943, the day when Sophie, entering Auschwitz, fell into the, quote, slow hands of the living damnation. I was able to come up, he searched his journals, his own diary, and he says, I was able to come up with the absurd fact that on that afternoon, as Sophie first set foot on the railroad platform at Auschwitz, what he doesn't know yet, but what I'm going to tell you is, Sophie's first choice, she has many, many choices in this book, and her ultimate choice is about faith or apostasy, not, but the first great choice she makes is when she gets off the train at Auschwitz, she has two children with her. I'll get to that. You can guess. As Sophie first set foot on the railroad station at Auschwitz, it was a lovely spring morning in Raleigh, North Carolina, where I was gorging myself on bananas. I was eating myself nearly sick with bananas, the reason being that in the coming hour, I was to take a physical examination for entrance into the Marine Corps. At the age of 17, already over 6 feet tall, but weighing only 122 pounds, I knew I had to put on 3 more pounds to satisfy the minimum weight requirement. One set, and Sophie. I have to read this to you. Wiesel asks, do we keep silent? Styron asks that too. Do we have a right to explore into the horrors of Auschwitz? George Steiner remarks that it's not clear that those who were not themselves fully involved should touch upon these agonies unscathed. I have been haunted, I must confess, Mrs. Stingo, by an element of presumption in the sense of being an intruder upon the terrain of the experience so bestial, so inexplicable, so undetachably and rightfully the possession alone of those who suffered and died or survived it. a survivor, Elie Wiesel, has written, novelists made free use of the Holocaust in their work, and in doing so, they cheapened it. I cannot accept that. Nor do I agree with the idea that in the presence of certain realities, art is trivial or impertinent. The embodiment of evil, which Auschwitz has become, remains impenetrable only so long as we shrink from trying to penetrate it, however inadequately. Everybody got that? We have to. So he makes a stab at not trying to penetrate Auschwitz, but at trying to understand Sophie. I'll stop because I've gone, yeah.
May I ask a question?
I hope I can answer.
Well, it's kind of directed at the class, too, the group. Ever since the war, the end of the war, perhaps as a means of expunging our guilt and having turned away Jewish refugees at a time when we could have saved some of them, or turning kind of a blind eye at what was going on when we knew at least part of it, that we've delighted in beating that subject of the Holocaust over and over again. It's also a convenient way of turning our attention away from ourselves. I wonder how many people know of Colonel Chivington and the Sand Creek Massacre. Does that ring any bells? I'm sure we've all heard of the what was euphemistically called by the 7th Cavalry the Battle of Wounded Knee. Anyone heard of the Battle of Wounded Knee?
Yes.
How many of you know the circumstances? Isn't that convenient? It's much easier for us to turn that microscope and examine over and over and over again what happened in Germany, and not in any way to mitigate the guilt. But it makes us feel much better if we don't bother to examine our own history.
I think one of the wonderful things about Sophie's choice is that it does just that. It forces us to recognize, because it's not Sophie's story. It's not an analysis of Sophie and her place in Auschwitz. It's an analysis of Stingo's confrontation with that experience of Sophie's. And as I said earlier, Stingo is us. And we become aware of our connectedness to Sophie, and not just those physical scars that have brought about the term the Holocaust, but those profound, poignant spiritual scars that are a part of who Sophie is, the part of her apostasy. The part of Sophie's final choice is to decide, can I live in a world like this? And Stingo in this novel is posed really against Sophie. Stingo, who loves Sophie, has a night of sex with her, but that's not how he loves her profoundly as a dear friend. And that's clear in the book. Stingo loves Sophie, and Sophie loves Stingo as a friend, and Sophie loves Nathan, who is going to be her destruction because he is sick. He's sick in a way that is dismissed because it's chemical and biological, and he almost parallels the sickness of the whole Nazi regime. That's something to look for, I think. But at the end, Sophie's choice is, do I choose that evil rules the world and is so powerful that that good can never transcend, or is there some good in the world? And Sophie chooses, evil is too strong, and she takes a pill. And she and Nathan die in the end of the novel. And Stingo makes this wonderful statement at the end that says, is this a depressing novel? Stingo chooses the opposite. There's a nice little episode at the end, but he comes up out of this drunken stupor that he's been buried in the sand, and he gets up and he says, oh, it's not Judgment Day. It's only morning, bright and fair. Suggesting, I think, that Stingo is very, very acquainted now with death and with love. And he knows the power of evil, but maybe at the worst, he's chosen not to choose. That is, evil exists and it's incredibly powerful, but love does too. And for now, those two will be at battle. Whereas for Sophie, evil has won. And we can understand why. And there's more that happens to Sophie in America in this novel in addition to what happened to her at Auschwitz. And Stingo's final choice, then, it comes out of a poem that he himself wrote when he was younger, which is just one line from that he remembers. He says, let your love flow out on all living things. And he begins to understand the connectedness of each individual, whether in Auschwitz or in New York, on all living things, and he talks about ants and bugs and trees and the whole creation and how humans are connected to and responsible for all of that. Anybody else? We've got a few minutes on my watching. If you're interested in reading this, I brought along the study guide that I give my students. And it just kind of summarizes in 3 pages some of the things that you can look for. And then there's about 40 quotes that are really critical in the novel that I have, when I do with my students, and you guys are way ahead of them, but I should go through and find these quotations, underline them before you read the book. And then come back, and as you come through those quotations, they'll just kind of stand out and they'll set up some connections for you that maybe otherwise you wouldn't have gotten. And so at least I know my students have read those quotations. I'll go back to the students who say it's the best book I've ever read. Anybody else, anything?
Following up what you just mentioned, probably Love and Evil, does the book also more or less look at nation as nation evil or country evil or just individual persons are evil to begin with and yeah. Love has to conquer over?
That's a wonderful statement. And the answer is yes. It does both. And it sees national evil as a responsibility of people who allowed it to happen by keeping silence.
In essence, the country and people in itself have to want to conquer others.
Somebody has to, I mean, to be specific with this book, somebody has to say something.